This is why people like robots. They're always on task. But might there be a benefit to humans' capacity to have their mind wander? And I thought, well, you know, what work culture, 21st century work culture does is it kind of pushes us toward the opposite. It just keeps us working without any opportunity for the mind to wander.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturesson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Arts Management. To measure the ROI on culture is like measuring the ROI of air. Culture is not optional, but a fundamental part of how we operate as a group. It influences every aspect of our organization, how we make decisions, think, communicate, collaborate, and perform. And at the heart of culture are people and relationships. While many organizations will claim that they put people first, it's easy to fall into cultural assumptions, drives, and beliefs that are truly harmful to our people and ultimately to the organization's mission. Some time ago, I read a fascinating article in Harvard Business Review about the dangers of a culture that glorifies busyness. The author, Adam Waits, is an award-winning social psychologist and associate professor at Northwestern University Kellogg School of Management. He's the author of The Power of Human, How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World. He uses methods from social psychology and cognitive neuroscience to study how people think about other minds and to investigate processes related to ethics, intergroup processes, and the psychological consequences of technology. I know that's a mouthful. On this episode of the Leading Transformational Change podcast, I'm very excited to bring you a conversation with Adam. We discuss what leads to dehumanization in our organizations and what we can all do to counteract it, how AI implementation impacts how we measure the ethicality of an organization, why a culture of business is a problem, and what we should do about it. A very wide-ranging conversation, as you can hear. Or, to summarize it all, how to put humans at the heart of our organizations. So if that's important to you, without further ado, I want to jump into my conversation with Adam Waits. Adam, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Great to be here.
I've been really excited about this conversation and reading up about the work and the research that you've done and your writing and your book and The Power of Human. And it feels like you kind of span a rather broad spectrum that I think relates to many of the topics that we talk a lot about on this podcast in terms of culture and ethics and more human workplaces and so on. So I'm very, very excited. And I wanted to start talking a bit about the topics that you bring up in your book. And I've heard some great talks from you on as well. And you talk about how over the last five decades, we've seen a subtle engaging and increasing dehumanization toward each other. And you talk about that it kind of relates to the rise of automation, stratification, which is the rise of income inequality and political polarization and marketization. And I wanted to ask you, how do you see that this shows up in our workplaces?
Right. So, you know, I wrote the book in 2019, and I think those forces are still at play, some even more so than now, if we think about the rise of automation. But I was thinking about all the different factors that pull people apart, that separate them, maybe into very tightly knit groups, but into more atomized individuals who need not rely on other people. And so what happens is we become less reliant on other people, less engaged with other people. Again, to use automation as an example, less inclined to just meet face to face. And this was exacerbated by the pandemic, of course, as well. And even though I'm a big, huge proponent of work from home, I do think there is something lost when we don't engage with each other at a deep level face to face. So when I talk about dehumanization, I'm talking about everyday dehumanization, not like genocide, but the type of dehumanization where I just fail to consider, oh, what's my colleague feeling? What's this person thinking about today? And things like that.
That's very interesting. And of course, it's so interesting to just like alluded to here, how the pandemic has impacted this. And I think it's been really interesting in the conversations around work from home or return to the office that, and again, I'm not saying this to say either for or against any of those options, but just I think it's very interesting that so many times the only kind of value that we talk about is productivity. And it seems like we don't really talk about other values that I think are also related to what is important for us in our work experience. What's your perspective on that?
So my sense is that, you know, a lot of the research early on suggested, oh, you know, you need people in the office for collaboration and creativity and productivity and these things like that. That was done sort of earlier in the pandemic. And I think now we've gotten the hang of how to work with each other remotely. So I think in terms of work, like you said, maybe this disconnect from others is not necessarily a negative, might be a plus. You know, people talk about being more productive working from home. You don't have someone knocking at your door. You can be in a more comfortable space. You can be more authentic when you're just by yourself. You don't have to waste time with a commute, all those things. But there is this other component of work, which I have some complex feelings about, which is sort of the social connection that you get with other people. And so I think where, say, remote work or working from home is challenging is, for example, for new hires, people who need onboarding, people who need to get a better sense of, you know, what is the company culture like? What is the camaraderie like around the office? For me, I've been in my job since 2011. I kind of understand what my organization is all about. I know who's who, etc. But there's that other social component of work that is prone to this disconnect if we're all just kind of working through these mediated systems. And then on top of the automation discussion, we're just, you know, split up in different ways. We all have our own kind of individual lives. That's part of the rise of individualism around the globe.
So when we talk about dehumanization and we talk about that like in the workplace, I'm thinking, what do you see as the potential problems? What is it that we're losing in that sense?
Yeah, so the first part of the book was drawing on my research and others' research to say, well, why does seeing humanness, and by humanness I mean just seeing the presence of a human being, understanding another person's mind, even seeing minimal cues to human presence, like, oh, a person crafted this mug. It wasn't just a machine. And so, you know, I go through, I think, four different reasons why humanness is psychologically powerful. And I suppose these things could be used for ill means as well, but I think they're quite good things. So one is when we see humans in the world, humans activate our moral sense. When we see another human, okay, all of a sudden that's a person who needs to be treated with care. They have some moral responsibility, but you know, we need to care for them. So like take the example of there's conversations around hiring and firing workers, layoffs. Oh, you know, you heard this conversation the other day. You should be slow to hire, quick to fire. That's what's good for a startup. That's treating human beings like commodities. When you realize, oh, wait, those hires and fires are human beings, I think that lends itself to more compassion. So that's kind of the morality component. And then there's the meaning component as well, that human touch just imbues things with meaning, which is why people are more willing to value art that was created by human beings, products, goods, artisan goods that were made by human beings. These studies I often refer to, that seeing the person who prepared your sandwich makes you enjoy the sandwich more. Somehow the presence of a human being gives processes and products credibility and meaning. And then also humans can influence us to do things, to take collective action in important ways, you know, tackle issues by like climate change. You know, people are more compelled to engage in environmentally friendly behaviors if you tell them, hey, your neighbors are doing this as well, your other human beings are doing this, rather than just giving them some pragmatic argument, oh, this is good for the planet. And finally, humans are motivating. I think this is probably what ties most directly to workplace context. So all this work by Adam Grant and others on, you know, the power of beneficiaries, we now know, shows that people are motivated by a variety of things. They're motivated by money, certainly. But when you learn that your work has benefit for another human being, it really, really motivates you in a sustainable way to feel like, wow, my work has impact. And yeah, this impact is powerful. And so knowing that a customer benefited from your work or another colleague benefited from your work is very motivating as well. So by saying, here's why human beings matter to us psychologically, I'm making the argument that if we just fail to notice humanness in our midst, or if we're in an increasingly mediated world where we communicate through technology and systems, some of that is going to go missing.
This is super interesting, and I think also helpful. And I think over these last maybe year, I think we've heard several stories of companies that have performed these kind of large scale layoffs that have been quite impersonal, in the sense that it's been or maybe suddenly somebody realized they couldn't any longer access their email, or they got an email saying that they were fired, or they were called into a kind of big group Zoom meeting or something like that. And I'm just thinking that in that process, not saying necessarily that the firing was wrong or uncalled for, just that process in itself, that it is, in a sense, perhaps dehumanizing, and that perhaps we would have approached it in a different way if we would have to face someone face to face.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. Even, you know, big companies, big tech companies do these layoffs, and yeah, you find out when your key card doesn't work, oh, I've been laid off. I think what technology enables us to do is have some psychological distance from people. And when we have psychological distance, we don't think about, well, yeah, there's another human on the other side of this who has feelings. And even beyond the case for compassion, there's a reputational case to be made that if you become known for being callous toward layoffs, people aren't going to want to work for you. And so, yeah, the layoffs really is these layoffs examples from these big tech companies. Those are kind of key examples of how people increasingly, and this is part of what I talk about in terms of marketization, I think are just viewed in terms of commodities rather than human beings. They're stores of value. And oh, if we, you know, need to cut costs, what's the first thing to do? It's not going to be reduce the CEO's salary, it's going to be layoffs. It's going to be try to automate things instead. And those are human beings.
I'm also thinking about this in terms of processes. I had a conversation with Denny, I think, Gioia, who was working as the recall manager at Ford during the Pinto scandal. And he had several opportunities to recall the Pinto. And of course, he couldn't do it, but suggest that it would be recalled. And he shared with me how kind of the system was made in a way where you shouldn't take into account your emotional feelings about the human beings that were victims of, for example, a car that malfunctioned in a certain way, but you should just kind of stick to the process. And of course, there's a case to be made for that, and there are processes that are important. But I'm thinking in terms of both that sense of of, what should I say, avoiding ethical lapses, but also in terms of, if we think of the quality of our products, let's say you're a med tech company, and if you can get people to think about that, what I'm producing now, that what if my kind of grandmother or someone I knew relied on this product, how would I treat the quality, and how would I speak up in cases where I would see deficiencies and so on. What are some things, Adam, that you've found that companies and organizations can do to kind of help put humanity in that sense at the center, both in terms of how we treat our employees, but also in terms of our customers and communities?
Well, we'll start with the negative examples. I mean, the Ford Pinto is a classic case where, you know, they had designed the car in a way such that the fuel tank would potentially explode if it was rear-ended. And when it did explode a few times, you know, Ford was brought to trial and a couple people died or injured. And when Ford, you know, famously defended itself, you know, how could you bring this car to market knowing that it was possible that this would explode and cause damage to cars and injuries and deaths? They basically said, oh, well, we did a cost-benefit analysis, and they showed, you know, this infamous Ford memo that said, look, we calculated a cost of how much it would require to repair each car that we estimated would explode. And we calculated the cost for each injury that someone would endure. And we calculated the cost of each death that would happen. And so, yeah, maybe that makes sense from an economic or even a legal point of view, but normal people don't think that way. They say, oh, you're putting a dollar amount on a human life. You calculated how much a death would cost you. And okay, maybe that's what actuaries have to do, but you don't, that's not solely where your business ends, treating a death of a customer as a statistic. And so that's sort of the extreme version of, yeah, deliberately not treating your customer as a human being, but oh, what do they cost if they die? Even similarly, in more recent years, when General Motors had an issue with the Chevy Cobalt, they had a issue with the ignition switch that could jam up on the highway. And they knew about this issue and they had chances to recall it. Didn't. Car jammed up several times. I think 124 people were killed. People tried to raise the issue. If you look at kind of Ford's safety training, they similarly talk about don't use words when you're writing a safety report that have any emotional tone to them. You know, in other words, don't kind of bring any humanity into this. Describe exactly what didn't work. Don't use a word like dangerous, you know, that has some emotional flavor. So I'm thinking about the negative examples first, and, you know, might things be different if we fully have our safety engineers meet potential customers? You know, on the flip side, that's what like a company like Medtronic will do. A medical device company, have people who work for Medtronic meet individuals who have benefited from their medical devices, you know, really introducing people who are beneficiaries of your work. Or, you know, fundraisers now know that, you know, giving donors, potential donors, access to someone who has benefited from the fund you're asking them to donate to increases their willingness to donate, because you see, oh, my work has impact. And then, you know, I also have talked about research that does this with people's colleagues. When people know that their work can benefit a colleague, they tend to work harder. There's some work on these pro-social bonuses, like a Belgian pharmaceutical company working in a sales team. If you're told that, you know, your bonus for sales is not going to go to you, it's going to go to you to be spent on your teammates, people will actually work harder and sell more. So people, that just tells me that people are motivated to benefit other human beings. And then there's things as simple as, you know, I've heard of companies that just have a single day of volunteering. You know, people like to know volunteering in the community, maybe irrespective of the company itself. Discover Financial Services does this. And, you know, that one day of volunteering can just make me feel like, ah, as part of my work, I also get to do something purposeful for other humans in the world, and that can be motivating as well.
Thank you. And I love that example of Medtronic and creating that connection with who our client actually is, and understanding the importance of our products. And I think another thing that I think is really important to talk about here, that is, of course, AI, and which is really a major global conversation, especially since OpenAI released ChatGPT, and we suddenly saw so much more what these systems are capable of. And of course, there's a lot of both excitement in terms of the possibility, and there's also a lot of people who are warning us of where this might take us, and we're not gonna go perhaps into those bigger scenarios. But I've done, as I understand it, some research on this, and you write or talk about that humans imbue our lives morality, and that, for example, research shows that we are less likely to hold a company accountable for example, discriminatory practices if an AI perform them than if a human does. So how should we think about this? Because of course this becomes, and of course you could say from one side that if a company wants to just keep themselves from being legally liable, then of course using AI, like, of course it becomes very, very tempting if people will hold them less accountable. And I guess that also is kind of the issue that if our only focus when we think about ethics and a healthy culture is on avoiding risks, we're not actually going to have a very, very good focus. But what do you think that organizations need to think about as we want to kind of leverage this technology, but at the same time, I think the listeners of this podcast and most of the CEOs and leaders I meet still want to build a company that they can be proud of, and an organization that actually doesn't do damage to humanity in that sense.
Well, I'll first unpack the research we did, because it's a little confusing on its face. I mentioned, you know, humans kind of signal morality. There can also be, well, humans can also be immoral as well. So they signal morality, immorality, and people's views. We're just talking about people's perceptions. People see human and they say, this is a moral entity. It can do good, it can do evil, etc. People's views of machines, and again, just their views, their lay theories, are that machines are relatively objective. They're kind of blind to emotional components and things like that. And so in our studies, the simple finding was that, you know, if you have a group of people making a hiring decision, and the hiring decision is, say, discriminatory toward women, or if you have an algorithm make a hiring decision and the algorithm's decision ends up being more discriminated toward women, people are actually less outraged at the algorithm. And the reason why is because there's this belief that, well, humans can be sexist, but an algorithm cannot. An algorithm can just compute. And so this idea of kind of some sexist motivation or intent behind the decision, that activates moral outrage. You don't get that from the algorithm. So, you know, I guess one unfortunate takeaway from this research is that if you want to, you know, get off the hook from discriminating, you know, in terms of if you want to evoke less outrage, use an algorithm based on our research. But, you know, that's not the whole story. I think there are probably, you know, this is just one piece of research. I imagine people have fairness concerns as well. And they think, well, a machine shouldn't be the only thing making the decision here. I mean, I think the answer is to have humans and machines working together. Because on the flip side of this, you know, for all of this talk about algorithmic bias and how algorithms can and do discriminate, I often reference my colleague at Booth, Sendhil Molinethan, who has written about and showed how AI can actually be easier to de-bias than human beings. So humans are biased, AI is biased because AI picks up on what humans do. But if anything, AI seems easier to de-bias. So can you formulate a system where maybe you are using some algorithm to, you know, take a first pass at resumes, but do you provide a human being providing a check on that system to say, wait, do we have the right inputs here? Because, you know, famously, Amazon a few years ago tried to use this algorithm to hire, and they trained the algorithm on all of their kind of existing resumes. Existing resumes are disproportionately male. And so what does it predict future hires? It's picking up on, oh, well, we should exclude people who have these, you know, female indicators in their resume for various reasons. That's not what we want. You know, one person could look at that and say, see, this is why we shouldn't have algorithms decide anything. Another person could say, oh, humans noticed this. Humans can alter the algorithm, provide more effective inputs that aren't discriminatory. And I think this kind of working together system might be most optimal.
So we're going to shift focus a bit. And you wrote a really fascinating article in Harvard Business Review about a culture of busyness and how business has become a status symbol. And I clearly recognize that in my own life and interactions. And I'm sure our listeners do as well, how often I guess we've gotten questions like, how are you? And we kind of feel the need to say, oh, it's been very intense, or I'm very busy, or whatever. And it feels like it's a great thing. It's something to be proud of. And if we weren't busy, if we weren't in an intense season, that kind of shows that we're not successful, that we're not performing, that we're not, yeah, whatever. And of course, it's so interesting to reflect on that. And we're going to talk about the kind of organizational consequences of a culture of busyness. But why do you think that we glorify busyness?
This is actually something I started thinking about out of thinking about automation and, you know, what is it that humans can do that machines can't, or vice versa. And, you know, this guy that I met, who is, I think, a venture capitalist investing in, you know, big tech companies, he said, oh, you know, I said, what do you think? What can a robot do that a human can? He said, a robot's mind can't wander. And I thought, well, that's really interesting, because that, I mean, this is why people like robots. They're always on task. But might there be a benefit to humans' capacity to have their mind wander? And I thought, well, you know, what work culture, 21st century work culture does is it kind of pushes us toward the opposite. It just keeps us working without any opportunity for the mind to wander. And I think this comes from a variety of things. You know, one, I'd talk about how busyness has become a status symbol. People think that busyness is equals good. Busyness equals productive. There's even work showing that busyness equals moral. People perceive that, you know, this goes back to the Protestant work ethic, this idea that, you know, it's inherently ethical to work hard. And then I think, you know, a lot of work cultures incentivize busyness too. I mean, I guess law firms are kind of the canonical example of you get paid based on billable hours often, rather than did you do a quality job. Necessarily, that's a little bit of a false dichotomy, but, you know, I think there are incentive structures set up in that way. I think work has become more part of our identity in a negative way. People just identify with their jobs in ways that they used to not. You know, a job used to be a paycheck, and now it's we're told, oh, we have to find our purpose, we have to find meaning. And then, you know, other things I write about in the article, we have an aversion to idleness. We're not very good at being alone in a room. by ourselves with our minds wandering. That actually feels aversive to a lot of people. And, you know, this also becomes just kind of mindless. You look around, you see everyone else working, and you assume I should work as well. And then finally, I talk about how, you know, customers seem to want to see someone busy at work for whatever they're getting. So for all those reasons, you know, busyness has kind of taken over our lives.
And of course, business and productivity are not the same thing. And I love the picture that is used in the article of just lots of people on this soccer field that are kind of all playing with their own balls. And of course, really showing the picture that we can be busy with a lot of things, but we might not necessarily be scoring on what's really important to the mission of the organization. So what are ways that organizations can better differentiate between productive work and just unnecessary business?
I list a few in the article, like, you know, changing the incentive structure. So rewarding the quality of output, not just how many hours people put in. Ideally, there's some balance you need to use between, you know, rewarding time spent, but also quality. There's some interesting studies that, you know, show that if you kind of incentivize people based on output, then that can be better for productivity. I also talk about something I've been talking about for a while, which is you need to force people off the clock. If people are addicted to busyness, it's not enough even to say, hey, you get unlimited holiday. It's like, no, you have to take holiday. You have to go home. You have to shut off your email, work email. And some companies, they'll even like pay people to do this, you know, because it's so unnatural, I guess. So forcing people off the clock, which means managers have to be the role model and say, I'm not working either, because people will follow the leader. And then I talk about auditing yourself and your organization for, you know, deep work versus shallow work. You know, Cal Newport has this distinction between deep work versus shallow work. And deep work is essentially something that requires consistent attention, cognitively demanding tasks, but a lot of our work is shallow work. You know, okay, do we really have to have a meeting to decide, you know, where the seminar is going to be held? Someone just decide that, you know, delegate, not have everyone on the soccer field playing the, you know, the same role. And when we audit ourselves, it could reveal things like, oh, you know, I was having, you know, weekly meetings with students as realizing, oh, this is just kind of not necessary. Now I do, if you need to meet, let's set up a meeting. We'll do some deep dive then. But we don't need to have weekly meetings where we just kind of like rehash the same thing over and over. And then I think talked about this idea from engineering, which is building some slack into the system. So this is a little bit something more far afield for me, but the idea is, you know, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but instead of this idea of running lean, maybe you have two people who are responsible for the same thing. And so, you know, if one of them doesn't get too overwhelmed, something like that, you know, that's an example of having a resource slack. So those are some kind of organizational components. But, you know, since I wrote the article, people are asking me about, well, what can I do in my daily life to feel less busy? And that research I haven't gotten started yet with, but, you know, I'm thinking of sort of even radical ideas like, what if one thing you could do is just every day cross something off your to-do list. Say, this doesn't need to be done, you know, already. That, you know, wouldn't that make you feel good? Or, you know, a real psychological reason why we always feel so busy is that there's this very well-known finding that finished tasks go out of memory. Unfinished tasks linger in memory. And so maybe part of what we need to do is commemorate finished tasks more, to remind ourselves, oh, I did something today. Because it's like, oh, as soon as you, even if you've been working on something for years, like I'll write an article that takes, you know, 5 years from idea to publication. As soon as it gets published, I don't want to think, oh my God, I'm so busy with all the work I haven't done yet. So maybe if we commemorate, do a better job of marking finished work, we'll have a better sense of accomplishment and less sense of, oh, I'm just busy with the next thing that's taking up space in memory.
I love that, Adam. And I think that is such a great practice. And it's one that I've had a mentor who told me something similar. And he says that he tries to, at the end of each day, kind of just sits with a cup of tea and tries to just reflect on, okay, this is what got done today. This is good. I'm grateful. And I've accomplished this. And I think I struggle so much with that because I always feel all the things that I haven't gotten done yet. And I always put too many things on my to-do list. So I think that's really helpful. And I also think that it's something that we can actually do as teams, as organizations, and actually celebrate our accomplishments, even in the small things, and say, okay, this is what we got done this week. So we're soon going to close this conversation. And of course, we talked about this culture of business and how we spend time on the wrong things so easily. And there's another part of your research here that I found super interesting. And again, we're shifting topic a little bit, but you talk about startups, and I think this is incredibly interesting, because something that I found in terms of building a healthy culture, that one of the greatest threats to a healthy culture is the assumption that we're healthy. And I would say the same, of course, is true of our physical health, and that we just, if we assume that we already are healthy, we're not going to do anything to get better in that sense. And you talk about how we assume that startups are more virtuous and we're therefore less critical of their unethical or morally questionable behavior. And I think that might be true of different kind of organizations and different kinds of reasons. For like in our part of the world, in the Nordics, we might say, oh, but we are a Swedish company, so because of that, we are more ethical or whatever, or we are an NGO. And I hadn't at all reflected on it in terms of a startup. Could you say something about that and what you found in terms of how we look at startups?
Yeah, well, this is really an idea led by Monica Gomez-Jokic, who's a professor at Purdue, and my colleague Mariam Kuchaki at Kellogg. So you know, this is really Monica's initial idea that people have this stereotype, you know, despite the scandals we hear about with like Theranos or WeWork or whatever. In general, people have a stereotype of startups as being more virtuous than established companies. This might be kind of an anti-establishment stereotype too. Oh, you know, all these big profit-seeking companies aren't as moral. And what that means is that outsiders, it's unclear if insiders do this, when a company morally transgresses, when a startup company morally transgresses, we are more willing to kind of give it the benefit of the doubt. You know, we're more likely to excuse its behavior, less likely to condemn its behavior compared to an established company. So, you know, like one study, let me think, is just showing people that there's this company described as an established company that hires people, but doesn't provide them any benefits, no health insurance or social security. Or we say, you know, there's this company and it's a startup and it doesn't provide them any benefits. You know, is this morally acceptable? Well, people find it more morally acceptable for the startup to do this. And, you know, these aren't like major moral violations, but they're just kind of ethically questionable things. And startups tend to get excused because of this virtuous stereotype.
That's so interesting. And of course, we've touched a broad range of subjects today, but I think a key point is how we can keep humans in that sense at the center of our organizations and of our cultures, and how easy it is that we assume things like we just talked about startups being more virtuous, and the danger of when we are only focused on avoiding risk, we're not going to make the right priorities. So Adam, thank you so much for a very insightful conversation. And lastly, I just wanted to ask you, how can people connect with you and learn more about your work? I know you have a website and lots of articles and so on. So please give us some direction.
Yeah, my website is adamwaitz.com, AdamWaitz.com. My contact is there. If anyone is interested in speaking or consulting or research opportunities, happy to chat. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Adam. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.